and the lowest string on your cello, the C.
I'm Tom Heisinger. It's NPR Music. You know, these days it's not unusual to find classical musicians performing in unlikely places like pubs and clubs and out-of-the-way venues, but long before this current trend took hold, there was Matt Heimovitz. I think it must have been at least 10 years ago now when he lugged his cello across the country bringing music like this to barrooms and coffee houses. Heimovitz was a teenage virtuoso who took a traditional career path, but then made a turn along the way that led him to play in places like New York's infamous punk club CBGB's, and to explore the intersections between classical jazz and rock music, and to start his own record label. Heimovitz is here performing in Washington, D.C., and I asked him into our studio not to play his cello, but instead to play guest DJ. Matt, welcome.
Thanks for having me here.
Sure. I'd like to ask musicians this question. Do you remember the first music that really made a big impression on you?
Well, I remember a lot of piano in the house. That made an impression, but...
You came from a musical family?
My mother was a pianist and had 40, 50 students coming every week. And I just remember lying down underneath the piano and just soaking in the ring of the instrument. And that's how I grew up.
Did it make you want to play the piano?
No, not at all.
You were sick of it by that time.
I was totally sick of it. And so many kids and older, students were coming in. And it just seemed like something so usual and... Seems so easy, you just press right. The key down and a sound comes out. That's too easy.
It's like a little mechanical machine.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, do you remember the first piece of music that really kind of turned you on, where the light bulb went off like, holy cow, this is pretty cool?
Pablo Casals' The Six Suites of Bach. I remember that making an unbelievable impression when, I got a hold of that for
right.
the first time in a LP set.
Kind of a groundbreaking recording of the six Bach solo cello suites. Well, so how did you end up, if the piano was in the house, you didn't like that. So how did you end up with the cello?
Well, I was kind of a jock back then, but I did go to concerts, and that was one thing that quieted me down. My mother always took me to the opera, and she took me to hear the great cellist, Mstislav Rostropovich, a recital in San Francisco. And that's what really blew me away, and the sound of the instrument and the mystery of how it was produced, and just getting a hold of those tools,
right.
I got very excited.
And then was it, Mom, I want a cello?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and they were thrilled to get me off the streets.
You mentioned going to the concert and seeing Mstislav Rostropovich produce that incredible tone that he had on that incredible cello, and he's on your list of the stack of CDs that you brought in today. A cello sonata by Frank Bridge, and I'm thinking even for classical fans, unless you're a cellist like you or a cello nerd, this Frank Bridge sonata is a little off the beaten path.
It is. I mean, Frank Bridge is the teacher of Benjamin Britten. And I chose it partly because, I was thinking I have to include one cello record. And it was tough. I could bring in Jacqueline Dupre, Elgar Concerto. I could bring in, the Casals or Starker.
Or one of Girls your own.
I wouldn't do that. But I thought this was an interesting pick. One, because I do think that Decca recording actually captures the sound of the cello and piano. It's one of the most beautiful sounding recordings for that combination. And that's a very tough combination to capture.
I can see why you like this. It's this beautiful, long-lined melody that opens it.
But also the textures in the piano and the harmony. It's really a unique piece.
And it's interesting because, he started this around 1913 or so and finished it a few years later, and music was really in kind of an upheaval then. We've already had Stravinsky's Rite of Spring at this point. Schoenberg was doing his thing, yet this is pretty resolutely romantic.
He stuck to his guns, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. this was the teacher of Benjamin Britten, and I love that Benjamin Britten is playing with Slava, and so this composer, performer, and just the idea that, you know, Slava not only was so important as a cellist, but also as the one who expanded our repertoire and who really pushed the cello to the fore and elevated the instrument up there with the violin and the other strings. So I thought that was a, you know, I just love that CD in general. I mean, I love the sense of discovery in the music making, mm-hmm. that it just seems to be in the moment and it feels live even though it's a studio recording, very rare. So it had all those elements, and just the, as you say, the gorgeous sound that he produced and the just vibrant music making.
Music by Frank Bridges, the cello sonata with Mstislav Rostropovich, cellist, and the pianist there, Benjamin Britten. So what's next on your list?
Well, maybe some Jimi Hendrix, Machine Gun.
Okay, that's a very big change.
Or do you want to do this gradually?
No, Hendrix is great. So at one point in your career, we mentioned earlier, you brought Bach and other music around to all these different pubs and coffee houses, and then a couple years later, then didn't you go around the U.S. again and you focused on American composers, and
that's right.
And you did another kind of pub crawl, and you were famous at that point for doing Hendrix's version of the Star Spangled Banner on your cello. Is that right?
That's right. Well, actually, I did that version for the first time at CBGB, the punk palace in New York City, which is now
no longer there.
No longer there, unfortunately. But that was on the Bach tour. I played Bach there, essentially. Mm-hmm. I played three suites. Punk bands wanted to get me off the stage.
Did they really?
Oh, yeah. I was sandwiched between a couple of them, and they were like, what is this guy doing here? I mean, the audience was very respectful, and they were there to hear what I was doing, but the bands couldn't quite get, you know, why I was there. And I was telling everyone in advance, I was saying, you know, I've always wanted to arrange the Jimi Hendrix Star Spangled Banner ever since I heard it in my first year of college. That's when I heard that from Woodstock. And but I was so afraid to do it. I just didn't do it. And literally, it was the day before the show, and I had told everybody was expecting me to do this new arrangement. Hadn't done it. And I took out, you know, the recording and listened to it a couple times. Went to the instrument, and I had the arrangement within 1 hour. It was unbelievable. Wow. It just suited the instrument so well. All the electric guitar distortion effects, everything I was doing acoustically. I mean, it everything fell into place, and I had it. So I was very relieved. If I didn't have the inspiration to do it, I don't know what I would have done the next day. I would have been very embarrassed. But anyway, I was happy it came quickly, and so we recorded it live there at CBGB.
So you've chosen this Hendrix song, Machine Gun. Did you know that song before you made this transcription of the Star Spangled Banner?
No, I didn't, actually. I started listening to Hendrix in college that first year, and I was just blown away and very envious of the electric guitar power that he had. I wanted that on the cello. And on one of my tours, playing Bach, actually, a fan burned me a copy of Band of Gypsies, and then I was just completely blown away. And again, you know, right at the height of, while we were steamrolling our way into Iraq, Machine Gun just made such a strong impression on me, not only musically, you know, the guitar solo is epic and just amazing, but also as a war protest song, I found it very moving.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that incredible guitar work of Jimi Hendrix from Band of Gypsies, Machine Gun, one of the choices of Matt Heimovitz, our guest today. ¶¶
made an arrangement of this for 8 cellos. And
oh, really?
I did it a week before my first daughter was born. So I was listening to this over and over and over again while my wife was, you know, in their last week of... I mean, we were actually... Wait, she was overdue, in fact. So we were kind of on pins and needles. Like, you know, when is this kid coming out? And then I'm sitting here listening to Machine Gun over and over again.
From Jimi Hendrix's Band of Gypsies record from 1969 or 68?
That's right, 69, Fillmore, yeah. The live Fillmore
right.
Show.
So, heavy-hitting guitarist makes me wonder if you...
I'm in the wrong business.
Did you have an electric guitar as a kid?
Or? No, not at all. Not at all. I grew up in a very sheltered classical music family. There was no electric guitar. I think secretly I must have wanted one. I just get my cello to sound like one occasionally.
You do. There's a you have an arrangement for a number of cellos of the Led Zeppelin song,
That's
Cashmere.
Right.
So you do kind of shred in your own way.
I try.
All right, let's get away from the guitar. You're the one that brought all the records today. It's quite a wide variety here. So what should we rack up next?
Well, maybe, you know, going from the electric, we've had a cellist, we've had the electric guitar. Maybe we should go to the voice, because that's what we all try to do.
That's right.
Sing on our instruments. And let's go, you know, Simone, Wild as the Wind.
Oh, that voice.
Exactly.
Woo.
Yeah.
Why this Powerful. Recording?
The album is kind of a mishmash, actually, but that particular tune just puts it over the top for me all by itself. It's worth the price of admission, because I just think it's one of the greatest recorded tracks ever. I'm so moved. How do you do that with a mic there? We're not listening to her live, you know? This is somehow
right.
captured, and just the breadth and power and vulnerability... And the fact that she accompanies herself, you know, on the piano.
Well, let's hear it. It's Nina Simone, Wild as the Wind, and she did this arrangement herself, actually, if I'm not mistaken.
Love me, love me, love me, say you do. Let me fly away with you. For my love is like the wind, and wild as a wind. Give me more than one caress.
Yeah, there's her interpretation, but then there's just, if you look at the voice physically, the, you know, the timbre and the color of the voice, they always say that the cello is the instrument that's closest to the human
right.
voice, and you hear Nina Simone sing, especially when she's a little bit in the lower register,
right.
And there is that resonance.
It's an incredible instrument, and also, I mean, just the vibrato, the range of vibrato that she has, and even the sort of microtonal pitch that she has through that is just, I find it so moving, and it's kind of an incredible story. She actually auditioned for Curtis, and she was refused.
As a pianist?
As a pianist, and she was refused from Curtis for being black.
I did not know that.
Yeah, she was actually not admitted. So, I mean, this is someone who brings together, you know, a classical background, her jazz...
Right.
Her blues, her, you know, it's just, it all comes together, I just find her very, very powerful.
Wild as the Wind, Nina Simone. Bob Boylan of All Songs Considered had Peter Gabriel as a guest DJ not too long ago, and he put Nina Simone's I Put a Spell on You on his list.
Oh,
and he said that he remembers hearing it as a kid over Radio Luxembourg, and he said it stank of human passion. And it drove him crazy. And he also said he loved the duet that she did with a saxophone at the end of the song, which is pretty incredible.
Hmm.
I'm Tom Heisinger. It's NPR Music, and I'm here with Matt Heimovitz, and he's got a stack of CDs, and Nina Simone is what we just heard. And he got another vocal here from Schubert. It's a long ways away from Nina Simone, but in a way, it's not. I mean, the songs are dark and aching and yearning, and That's... you have another intense performance. I think I almost see a little thread running through your choices here, and that there's an intensity to all of them.
Mm. I definitely favor recordings that feel live and spontaneous and Yeah, maybe there's a little angst in there, too.
So you picked a 1963 recording from tenor Peter Pears with his partner, Benjamin Britten, the composer at the piano, and it's Schubert's Winterreise. Why this recording?
Just the perfect complementary relationship between the voice and the piano. And the music itself, there's such simplicity to it. And, you know, the poetry is sort of bringing nature and sense of existentialism about this about this song cycle, but I find very moving, you know, the symmetry between Peter Pears and Benjamin Britten. You know, just that the piano provides this perfect tableau, and just with the simplest means creates these pictures in music.
It's a song called Frühlingstraum, which means the dream of spring, and let's hear a little bit of it now. It's basically about a guy who, in the middle of winter, because the whole song cycle, Winterreise, is a winter's journey, and this guy in the middle of winter, he dreams, like a fool, he says, of spring flowers, and of course, of love also. So it's Peter Pears, tenor, and Benjamin Britten, piano, from 1963, music of Schubert.
Von bunten Blumen, so wie sie wohl blühen im Mai. Ich träumte von grünen Wiesen, von lustigem Vogelgeschrei, von lustigem Vogelgeschrei. Und dass die Hähne krähten, da wacht mein Auge wach, da war es kalt und finster, da schrien die Raben am Dach. Da war es kalt und finster, da schrien die Raben am Dach.
I think you were drawn to vocal music because you said your mom took you to the opera as a kid, right?
Yeah, although my brain is really wired for instrumental music.
Uh-huh.
The idea of bringing words into it. I didn't get into opera until much later. With the piece like this, I can really get into it because the music is so closely, it's such an interpretation of the words, and having the words just grounds it for me in that way. So this is ideal for me.
The tenor was Peter Pears and the pianist Benjamin Britten from Schubert's Winterreise from 1963, and that song was The Dream of Spring, Frühlingstraum. Let's see, where should we go next?
Well, since we were on a journey, maybe John Coltrane's A Love Supreme.
Well, that's a spiritual journey, kind of, isn't it?
It's a different kind of journey.
It's a heavy journey. That's good.
Yeah.
How'd you get turned on to Love Supreme?
Well, I actually commissioned a composer, David Sanford, to write a piece for me. He wrote Seventh Avenue Kaddish, which was a response to September 11th. And that piece was modeled after A Love Supreme.
Oh, okay.
So I went back and studied it, listened to it back in 2001, and it just blew me away. But also reading the poem that John Coltrane wrote, just this unabashed spiritual poem, you know, just all about his relationship with God. And,
right.
And the fourth part is, in fact, his musical rendition of that spiritual poem and finding enlightenment and connection to a higher spirit.
He doesn't recite the poem, but he recites it on a saxophone.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. In musical terms.
And it's almost set up like a four-part suite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Or symphony.
So let's see. Love Supreme, it's a big, long, you know, like album, long hymn of praise, people have called it. Where do you want to dip in?
Pursuance, the third part, a little more active. And, you know, really the moment of struggle or the search. Thank you.
part of John Coltrane's A Love Supreme Pursuance, the third part of the four-part piece. And Coltrane and, let's see, that's kind of the classic quartet. So that's going to be McCoy Tyner on piano and Elvin Jones on drums. And, all right, you got me on who the bass player is.
Jimmy Garrison.
Okay, there we go. We're just sitting around spinning records with cellist Matt Heimovitz. You know, you've got a few things on your list that are very much, you know, either straight-ahead jazz or jazz-influenced. Did you listen to much jazz as a kid? You said you grew up in a household that was, your mom gave piano lessons, a lot of classical music. Any jazz happening as a kid?
No, not at all. But again, in that first year of college, that's when I started to get really interested in improvisation. I met a composer, Stephen Mackey, and we just spent the whole year at Princeton jamming with him on electric guitar and me on cello. And that's when I started discovering Miles Davis, John Coltrane.
Right. That's probably why you like Band of Gypsies, because it's really a big jam band record in a way. Yeah.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I became really, really fascinated with improv. And also, I just admire it because I come from this world of interpretation where I deal with the score all the time, and you're looking for authenticity, you're looking to go below the surface of the music and really get to the heart of what the composer intended. But it's always about the composer.
Right. It's always about those notes on the page.
Absolutely. So I do envy to some degree these players that can just make it up.
These days, if you're not an organist, or maybe someone in the early music field, classical musicians aren't known for improvising.
Not anymore. And it used to be. I mean, Bach used to be the rock star improviser of his time.
Right. Do you improvise yourself?
I do from time to time. I'm going to be jamming with Flea in a couple days.
Really?
Yeah. And Chris Riley and I, on our last album, we jam on Lotus. That's a pretty indulgent 9-minute improv that we did. That was completely improvised.
So what's a jam session with Flea going to be like?
I don't know. This is going to be live.
It's
going to be live in Pasadena, yeah, right at Caltech. We're both going to be playing some Bach. He's going to play some two duets from the D minor suite, and I'm going to play several preludes.
Oh, I would like to be there. Is that going to be recorded?
I don't know what they're planning to do. I hope somebody's going to... I'm going to give my cell phone to somebody to get it.
All right.
Get a little video.
Well, we've got time for one more from your list. You gave a nice long list here. We've gone through Hendrix and Schubert and Frank Bridge. Where do you want to go next?
If I could, I would love to include the Pittsburgh Collective, a tune.
Speaking of jazz.
Yeah. Well, this really brings it all together to some degree because it's by David Sanford, composer who I admire greatly and who I've known for years now. He went off, got the Rome Prize, and wrote his big passion is big band music. So he put this band together, the Pittsburgh Collective.
It's kind of an irreverent big band, isn't it?
It is pretty irreverent, and they're amazing. They can read down the most complicated score you put in front of them, but they also, all of them, can jam. So David is this incredibly serious classical composer, but he really bridges this jazz world classical relationship. Anyway, when I heard the music, I said, you got to get me in this somehow, and he wrote a great cello concerto for cello and 20-piece big band, which is on the same album. But I chose Alchemy because just the sheer energy, and I love hearing this rhythm section and this jazz-based groove, but the music is being developed like a classical piece, so it's kind of jazz meets enlightenment.
Great. Let's hear a little bit of it. It's Alchemy, and it's by the Pittsburgh Collective. Starts out with all this energy, and then it stops on a dime. Like a little interlude here or something?
Yeah. Well, he just filters in so much music and makes sense of it.
So swinging like mad.
Yeah.
a tune called Alchemy from the Pittsburgh Collective. What's the name of the record?
Live at the Knitting Factory.
This was recorded live.
All right.
Favorites from cellist Matt Heimovitz, who was nice enough to come in and bring a bunch of music with him. You still play a lot of dates on the road. You're involved in so many different aspects of classical music, but also kind of like blurring the boundaries between classical and other types of music. If you look in your crystal ball, tell me what's happening with classical music. What's going to happen with classical music? You still feel good and positive? I mean, we have all these, the annual gloom and doom forecasts about what the classical music industry is coming to be or not to be.
Well, I mean, it's evolving, but I have to say that, I mean, the audiences that I'm encountering are better than ever, and people are hungry for really adventurous programming, and they recognize when something has been thoughtfully put together, and they want to be inspired, they want to be moved, and I'm feeling good about it personally, but certainly, you know, it's disconcerting to see orchestras suffering, and, you know, but I think they're in that situation, frankly, because their wheels have been spinning too slowly. And a lot of the chair music world has actually had to move a lot faster and could move a lot faster just because of the nature of what they're doing. And I see certain orchestras doing really interesting things with their programming and not only bringing in new works and working with bands and making it relevant for their communities. But I'm optimistic that, I mean, the music is too great. We just need some energy and reprioritizing.
I like hearing that. I like the optimism. Matt, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks a lot.
All right, we're going to leave with a little bit of your record that you made with Chris O'Reilly called...
Shuffle, Play, Listen.
All right, thanks, Matt.
Thanks.